We are talking today with Tom Hartman. Tom Hartman, who started in radio in 1968, is the host of a national daily progressive radio talk show available on XM and Sirius Satellite Radio. He is the four-time Project Censored award-winning New York Times best-selling author of 19 books currently in print in over a dozen languages. His most recent books are We the People, A Call to Take Back America, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, Unequal Protection, The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights, and he is here to talk about his new book, Threshold, The Crisis of Western Culture. Tom, thank you very much for spending time with us today.
Thanks for having me here, Mike. It's a pleasure to be here.
Start out and tell us what was the motivation in writing your book, Threshold, The Crisis of Western Culture.
Well, first of all, I have three children, and I think that there's a certain sense of obligation to the future. You know, the old, what's often attributed as a Native American saying that we borrow this planet from our children. And I think that our culture has kind of reversed that. You know, we're gonna use it however we damn well please, and they can fend for themselves. You know, that was probably part of it. Part of it is that, It was just making me crazy that I am constantly hearing people nibbling around the edges with regard to both the problems and the solutions. Global warming is not the problem. Pollution is not the problem. Carbon dioxide is not the problem. Overpopulation is not the problem. Those are all problems, but they are symptoms of a much larger problem. And the much larger problem is the one that's untouchable. It's the one that's unspeakable. It's the one you will never hear about on network news or in corporate television. The real problem is our culture. We have a dysfunctional culture. A culture is a set of assumptions, a set of stories that we all collectively tell ourselves about who we are, where we came from, where we're going, what our relation to each other is, what our relation to the world is, what our relation to economies and politics and technology, all of those things, all of that stuff makes up our culture. And it finds expression in how we live, how we speak, how we conduct ourselves, how, you know, everything that we do. And our culture says we must grow. Right, that we must have an economics of growth. Our culture says that it's entirely appropriate for a corporation to have the rights of a human being. Our culture says that patriarchy and hierarchy are the natural ways of things, and in fact natural to humanity. Science, by the way, contradicts both of those things. Our culture says that to internalize profits and externalize costs for a power plant not to have to, or an oil company not to have to pay for the millions of cancers that they're creating every year and the damage that they're doing to the environment, but instead just walk away with the profits and leave the rest of us to pay for that's just fine. And so, you know, at the very macro level, there are some very large cultural assumptions that we have failed at. One, that everything is sacred. We instead, as a culture, have been assuming that the sacred is found in a box that we go to on Sundays or Saturdays or Fridays. And the consequence of that is that because nothing is sacred, we feel, you know, perfectly willing to screw it up, right? Because it's not sacred, you know. And if there is something that's sacred, that's something sacred, you know, with the famous James Watt saying from the Reagan administration when he was asked why he was willing to sell off Western lands at literally a penny an acre to big mining companies that were going to pull thousands of dollars an acre worth of materials out of them. Of course, his later consulting company did very well with it. And he said, oh, well, Jesus is coming back and he'll make all things new. I mean, these kinds of bizarre cultural assumptions, this is at the heart of the problem that we're facing. And nobody was confronting them. And so I wanted to write a book and say, the problem, it's our culture, stupid, you know, kind of thing. You know, this is the real problem. It's how we think. It's not what we're doing. What we're doing is obviously some terrible problems. But we wouldn't be doing them if we weren't thinking that way.
Seems one of the sacred things we do focus on is the worship of the dollar in the economy.
Mm-hmm.
put that above all else.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, this whole thing of, you know, free markets has been raised to a religion, the religion of the free market. There's no such thing as a free market. It's like saying, let's have a free football game, right? No goalposts, no yard lines, no referees, no rules. You know, that's not football. You know, let's have a free baseball game. One team can have, they don't have to touch first. They can go straight to second. I mean, what? Markets have rules. We define the purpose of a marketplace. Just as one example, you know, there's many. We define the purpose of a marketplace. And historically, one of the things that separated the United States from European countries when we were started was that we were following the Enlightenment track. We were the founders of this country were big students of Jean-Jacques Rousseau, you know, the noble savage, and John Locke, you know, life, liberty, and the right to private property, actually, is what he, which was a heretical notion in 1635 when he was writing that, because the king owned everything. And even had the right to sleep with the bride on the first night in many countries, even still at that time. So the founders had this idea that wealth and land and power wasn't the sacred stuff, that the relationship between us was the sacred stuff, that, you know, we hold these truths to be self-evident, not that everybody can get rich, but that everybody has the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I mean, the Declaration of Independence was the first founding document in any country in the history of the world to have the word happiness in it. And these were people who saw much of the world as sacred. I mean, using that word very advisedly, and not in a box. You know, when Jefferson first wrote, you know, Nature's God, he's got Nature's God at the Declaration of Independence, and John Adams and Ben Franklin edited that thing over a two-day period, and you can see the original. Adams scratched out Nature's God and put the Christian God, and Jefferson scratches out the Christian God and puts no Nature's God, you know, because this was nature. And now we're finding out, and there's a study that I cite in the book Threshold about how with deer, the original study was done, but with all animals, from insects to primates, decisions are made democratically. They're not, virtually all animal societies are not organized hierarchically, except with regard to sex. That's it. The study with the alpha deer, for example, or with the red deer and the alpha deer, I thought it was particularly fascinating. Done at the University of Essex, and they had this herd of deer, and they put all these cameras in the trees and a couple of drinking holes nearby. And how do they know when to know which drinking hole to go to? I mean, these are actually important decisions, because if they go too soon, some members don't get enough nutrients. If they wait too long, some might get dehydrated. They've got to account for young and old. I mean, there's all these variables. So how do they know? Well, the assumption was the alpha deer would make the decision. After all, he fought himself bloody every spring to become the alpha deer. But it turns out that as the appropriate time to go get a drink comes, different deer start pointing their bodies in the direction of one of the three watering holes. And when 51% of them are pointing at one of the watering holes, within about a 4-minute period, the entire herd will form and move in that direction. And very often the alpha deer's in the back going, hey, where'd everybody go? And it's democratic. And then they said, okay, so how can we force the alpha deer to come out, you know, to assert his leadership? And so they put a predator near one of the watering holes. So now 50% comes and goes. Deer aren't moving. They're going, aha, the alpha deer is going to come out, you know, 52%, 53%, 55%, 60%, still no action. They're waiting for the alpha deer, 63%, 4, 5, 6. When they hit 66%, a two-thirds majority of the deer pointing at one of the watering holes, boom, off goes the herd, a supermajority. It's wired into our... And very often the alpha deer, again, is in the back going, where did everybody go? It's wired into our DNA. Democracy's in our DNA. You see a flock of birds flying through the sky, and all of a sudden they turn. And the entire flock. It's not like the lead one turns and the rest of them move. It's not like you know, you're looking at a freight train. It's like they all move at the same time. I used to think, how do they do that? They've got to be telepathic, right? Schools of fish You know, boom, 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 left, right, left, right. How do they do that? Turns out that after this research on the deer was published in Nature, I interviewed the scientists, Roper and Conrad, on this stuff. They started getting all these correspondences from ichthyologists and ornithologists and entomologists and all the people in all these different disciplines that were genus-specific or species-specific or whatever it is. I've forgotten my table, kingdom, phylum, whatever, who were saying, you know, we're doing like slow-motion photography and we're discovering that the school of fish, for example, you know, they, as they swim, they move left to right, you know, 3 degrees left, 3 degrees right, 3 degrees left, 3 degrees right. But, you know, there's always outliers. There's always fish who are moving like 4 degrees left and then back 3 degrees right and 4 degrees left, you know, and they're like trying to vote for left. Well, when 51% of them move that extra 1 degree to the left, the entire school moves a degree to the left. They have very, very fast peripheral vision, and they're all voting with every motion of their body. So this is an entire society that's voting maybe 100 times a minute. It's a democracy. I remember as a little kid watching a swarm of gnats, and they were just like this ball of gnats. I was sitting by this little creek near my house, you know, and just looking for crayfish and playing. I was 7 years old. And I still remember as if it was yesterday, this ball of gnats in the air just going, and it would just hover there, and then all of a sudden, it would move about 3 feet off, you know, to the distance, and there'd be maybe a dozen gnats left behind going, where did everybody? They were probably the alpha gnats, right? And where did everybody go? It turns out it's a democratic decision-making process. Even with ants, even with the highly social animals, they make decisions democratically. There's no leader. The only asset, the only benefit that the alpha deer gets for all that bloody head-beating that he goes through is that he gets first choice of sexual partner, which is perfectly consistent with Darwinian evolution. That makes perfect sense. The strongest animal has the first opportunity to reproduce. But in terms of the survival of the entire herd on a day-to-day basis with regard to decision-making, it's got nothing to do with the alpha animal in any species.
So it seems as a species we have completely disconnected ourselves from that innate ability to democratically make choices.
To a large extent, since Gilgamesh, since Sumeria, for about 7,000 years, we have embraced patriarchy and hierarchy. But the fact of the matter is, when I say we, I'm talking about our culture. This, you know, thus the subtitle, The Crisis of Western Culture. Because if you look at the Yanomami, or if you look at the Iroquois Confederacy, where in 5 out of the 6 Iroquois nations, men were not even allowed to vote. They were matrilineal, matriarchal societies where women made the decisions. Men, the sachems, made the visits. They made the journeys. They traveled from community to community to carry out the decisions. But the women voted. And what you find is that in these societies that they're highly egalitarian, they're highly small-d democratic, and things work. The women voting part I want to point to and focus on. It's kind of a digression, but population. You know, up to this point we've been talking about economics and democracy, and I was saying, you know, our assumptions about democracy are wrong, our assumptions about economics are wrong. There's no such thing as a free market, and democracy actually is in our DNA. Kingdoms and hierarchy are an aberration. Population, the world population at the time of Christ was 250 million people, 250 million people. That was a high point. I mean, it took 165,000 years of humans spreading all over the earth, literally all over the earth, to reach 250 million people. By the year 1000, we were at 500 million people. Finally, in 1800, we hit 1 billion people. So 165,000 years to get us to 1 billion people, and arguably millions of years. But, I mean, the oldest fully Homo sapiens fossils, 165. The second billion didn't take 165,000 years. It took 130 years, 1930. The third billion only took 30 years, 1960. The fourth billion took only 14 years, 1974. The fifth billion took only 13 years, 1987. The sixth billion took only 11 years, 1999. We're now working on our 7th billion people. It's amazing to think that the day that Franklin Roosevelt was sworn into office, if 2 out of 3 of the people around us, if 2/3 of the entire, all everybody on Earth were to vanish, the population would still be greater than it was on Earth when Franklin Roosevelt was sworn in. if 6 out of 7 people were to vanish from the earth right now, or 5 out of 6, argue 5 out of 6.5 were to vanish right now, there would be more people than there were on the earth at the time that this continent was being colonized by the Europeans. I mean, and the world was not lightly populated at that time. So the question is, why is this population explosion, which is arguably the primary driver for all these other ills, why is this happening? And up until recently, the assumptions have been that it's either economically driven or it is technologically driven. The technological driver, or restrainer, actually, is birth control. You know, the assumption that if only there was more birth control around, if only, you know, every third world country had bubble gum machines on every corner with birth control pills and you didn't even have to put a penny in, they were just free. If only we could airdrop condoms by the thousands, you know, every month. Well, it turns out the birth control, lack of access to birth control, is a very real problem around the world, particularly in the third world. But it's not the problem, because there are societies, the Middle Eastern ones are the ones that we're probably most familiar with, the oil-rich nations, where there are no cultural or religious proscriptions against birth control. It's easily and widely available, and yet still typical family size is 10. You know, women are having 11, 12, 13 children, or less, but the average family size is 10. So it's not technology that's causing the problem. Then the economists come along, the Paul Wolfowitzes of the world. You know, they say, oh yeah, the problem's economic. Because what you see is that when countries reach a certain level of economic wealth, they seem to go to zero population growth. I mean, look at Italy. They're in negative population growth right now. The home of the Vatican, ironically. And they actually have the highest compliance, the highest rate of birth control usage of any country in Europe, Italy. I love that stat. Anyway, their suggestion then is, let's raise the standard of living of everybody in the world to the kind of European middle class, or maybe poverty level, but, you know, or American poverty level. Americans, our median income is $44,000 a year, and our poverty level is $14,500. Let's get everybody up to $14,500. Well, consider half of the almost 7 billion people on the planet live on less than $5 a day. To get all of them to that standard of living would require the natural resources of 4 planet Earths. It's physically impossible. Secondly, it doesn't matter, because in those countries that have become rich and have not changed their cultures, those countries, for example, again, the Middle Eastern countries, you find, you know, there are countries where you get $20,000 a year simply for being a citizen. You know, it's just like what Sarah Palin does up in Alaska. Take the oil revenue and cut a check to everybody every year. She's just a small-time socialist. These are big-time socialists, you know, they write big checks. And still, the families are, you know, got 8-10 kids, and the populations are exploding, and they don't know, you know, the Saudis don't know what to do with all the people, and it's, you know, fill in the blanks. Turns out that the one variable that is absolutely solid, the one thing that defines whether a culture is going through population explosion or not, is the role, is the relationship, the power relationship between men and women. When women have relatively equal power with men, in a single generation, population will stabilize. And when women are the property of men, invariably you have population explosion. The fact of the matter is that the story that we've been telling ourselves, that the human population, the human race went to 1 billion in 1800, 2 billion in 1930, 3 billion in 1800, the population explosion, that's the story of the human race? False. That's the story of our culture. Because there are 1,000 other cultures on Earth that have been population stable for 10,000 years, 20,000 years, 30,000 years. In the case of the San in northern South Africa, the Kung, the Bushmen of the Kalahari, 60,000 years, population stable. It's an egalitarian society. Women have equal power with men. So, in a very real way, you can say, you know, geez, we've got these terrible problems. The world is melting around us. We're all going to die, blah, blah, blah. What do? Change the way we think. And so it's like what Greg Mortensen is doing in Pakistan, where he's going into, he wrote Three Cups of Tea, where he's going into these communities and he's building schools for girls. And now the women are empowered in the communities. And guess what's happening? They're throwing the Taliban out. They're saying, you know, we don't need this stinking stuff. They're embracing more moderate forms of Islam that are less hierarchical, less violent, and less patriarchal, and that are more embracing, just like Christianity has kind of gone through a reformation, and the United Church of Christ embraces everybody, but we've still got some Christian fundamentalists out there who say that, you know, women should sit in the back of the church and shut up. And by coincidence, they tend to have 8 kids in their families. So, anyhow, I'm ranting a bit. You get the point.
So what do you see then as concrete solutions? I mean, obviously we have to change the way we think, but mm-hmm. how do we do that as a society that's as large as ours is?
I think changing the way people think is a lot easier than we realize. Because when people get something, when they learn something, it's very hard to unlearn it. And if it's something that is not only intuitively true, not only logically true, but is actually true. You know, the story of democracy being in our DNA, which is why all tribal people throughout history, and in the book I tell the story of the Maori in New Zealand who ate the last moa bird on the island. I mean, they led to their own starvation, and they devolved into warfare and famine and, you know, this violent, violent society. And that Abel Tasman discovered, in quotes, and they even ate 3 of his sailors, and he sailed off. He was horrified and continued on to then Captain Cook 40 years later came along, and he continued on past New Zealand and discovered British New Caledonia, which was another 1,000 miles in the direction of Hawaii, where the same Melanesian people, only 3,000 years earlier rather than 800 years earlier, had occupied an island that was covered with the same moa birds. These are birds that are like 200 pounds, and you can walk up to them and break their necks, and you got a week's worth of food. And they ate all of them, and they were reduced to eating rats, like the people in New Zealand, like the Maori were. But no Europeans showed up, and they had to figure out how to work it out, and they couldn't leave the island, and they got nothing left, and they destroyed most of the edible fauna and flora. And they'd killed all the seals. And what they figured out was small d democracy, and they reinvented their society as an egalitarian, matriarchal, matrilineal society. And when Captain Cook arrived there, now those people, the Maori had only had 200 years, you know, just a couple generations of the horror of famine. And so they were still in the midst of the trying to figure it out stage. The New Caledonians were 1,000 years past that. And we're already into, okay, we've made the change, just as most of the native societies in North America had. And many of the African communities had as well, by the way. I mean, these were the stories that were coming back to France in the 1600s that caused Rousseau to write about the noble savage. And Captain Cook said, this is the most perfect and wonderful society, surely, that has ever existed on Earth. I mean, he was just blown away by it. He just wanted to stay there for the rest of his life. You know, he ended up, you know, dying in Hawaii just up the road, but, you know, he was just, his diaries about New Caledonia and several other societies that had reached that point read very much like the diaries of first contact of some of the early Americans, you know, with Native American societies when they had contact with these egalitarian societies. So I think that waking people up, you know, the work isn't so much, gee, we've got to do this, is once people are awake, it gets done. It was like 30 years ago, nobody knew what global warming was. And now we've got the world mobilizing. Might be a little late, maybe not. We'll see. But the fact of the matter is, once you've seen Al Gore's movie, you can't go back.
So you have hope then that we can turn this around at this point?
I have tremendous hope, because what history shows us is that human society after human society has crashed and burned, and come back after the crash and burn in ways that are not toxic. It has happened repeatedly. In fact, it's happened for virtually every human society that's not functioning in a toxic way. I have a lot of hope. And, you know, the democracies in our DNA, that we're, you know, we're wired for this. If we can just avoid destroying ourselves, if we can just avoid that, excuse me, I think we'll make it through fine.
Well, that's quite the trick at this point in time in history.
It is. it is. Although it also may be, you know, we may be thinking too highly of ourselves. I mean, it's back when Paul Ehrlich in the early 1970s wrote The Population Bomb, he predicted that millions of people would die of starvation, famine would increase, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, people poo-pooed it. And even now you'll find people saying, ah, that Paul Ehrlich, he was nuts, he was wrong. Fact of the matter is, he was right. It just didn't happen in the United States. It's happening in the third world all around the world. And it's happening particularly in those societies that adopted our culture and discarded their local culture. I start the book in Darfur. We were in Darfur a year ago, March, and on the border of Darfur in South Sudan, in a refugee community of 45,000 people with one well and one latrine. And it was originally a little town of 6,000 people, and I was talking to this young Dinka man. Dinkas are the local tribe, the local black Africans who are being overrun by the light-skinned Arab Africans from the north who are coming down, and that's the genocide that's happening in between North and South Sudan, and Darfur is kind of in the middle. It's actually off to the side, but, you know, politically in the middle. And he could name... He could tell me the Dinka names of some of the plants. I mean, we were surrounded, even though we were in a desert, we were surrounded by life. You know, it wasn't abundant in the dry season, but it was there. But he didn't know the healing properties of them. He knew that his ancestors knew. He knew that his, you know, I mean, this is a place where there's some of the most god-awful diseases on earth, and yet people have been living there for 165,000 years. His ancestors knew that, you know, Kinkona bark would cure malaria, but he didn't know that, right? So he came out of a culture that was perfectly adapted to that environment, to survival in that environment, and actually even life is good in that environment. And we came along with colonial activity over a 150-year period and imposed on them a culture that was ideally suited for industrial society and cities. Yet we were standing in a part of Africa where the nearest paved road was 400 miles away, and the nearest electricity was 400 miles away. I mean, literally, the nearest place you could plug something in was 400 miles away. And so our culture didn't, it was not at all useful to them. I mean, what they were left with was this little Presbyterian missionary group who had brought in one doctor, and they'd go and, you know, people get sick and they'd all pray to Jesus. They had forgotten the plants. They had forgotten the, you know, I mean, it was all gone. And so the point in my book, again, just to kind of summarize it and threshold the crisis of Western culture, is that the crisis that we're at, a series of thresholds, a series of doors that are open, you know, a series of door sills here, or sills. And we could step across them into the abyss, or we can step across them into a better world. And if we inform ourselves properly, we can make it a better world. And doing that requires us to learn the lessons of history that we're probably uniquely able to have, unlike many of our predecessors. You know, when Rome fell, the Romans weren't able to look back at 35 other societies plus maybe 200 indigenous societies and say, what lessons can we learn? We can.
In addition to your book, Threshold, The Crisis of Western Culture, do you have a website people can turn to?
TomHartmann.com is the website, you know, mostly for my radio show and for my books. All my books are there, and there's a couple hundred articles that I've written and things like that. Yeah, so there's a lot of resources there.
Very good. Well,
and however you spell it will get you there, by the way. We've got all the misspellings.
Okay. With that, we are unfortunately out of time. I want to thank you very much for spending time with us today.
Mike, thanks so much for having me here. It's been a pleasure.
Talking with Tom Hartmann, author of Threshold, The Crisis of Western Culture.